Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On this week's show...
I'm sure on some level every woman knows that there is a risk, but you're blindsiding it. You say, OK, I won't be affected. Something will be developed by the time I get to that stage. It's unlikely something will be developed really by the time, you know, in the next few generations, I would think.
Professor of Reproductive Biology Mary Herbert takes us through the latest scientific understanding of how women's fertility changes as they age. Also, I'll be joined by the Guardian and Observer's science team to discuss this week's science news, including a boost for research into ocean acidification and the genetics of obesity. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. We're going to kick off with the latest science news. With me is Nicola Davis from the new and wonderful Observer Tech Monthly. Nicola, it's your first time on this podcast. Welcome.
Hello, thank you.
Are you excited?
Very, of course.
Good, very good. Also, the Guardian science correspondent, Ian Sample, who's constantly excited about science, aren't you?
Yep.
Yeah. What's going on with your face?
I couldn't be bothered to shave.
Looks good. Looks very rugged.
I'm not doing it for you.
It's very sort of Dan Craig. Yeah.
Dan Craig.
Not Daniel, not quite Daniel. It's Dan Craig. It's like him just chilling out.
You're on familiar terms with these people now.
Nicola, let's start with your choice of story. The X Prize and ocean science. Quickly tell us what the X Prizes are and then what this new one is.
So the X Prize is basically set up in 1995 and it's a non-profit organization, and it sets big challenges for people to go and solve. So you might have heard of the Ansari X Prize, which was all about getting private manned space flight up and running.
And that was a £10 million prize.
That was £10 million, yeah. And that was very successful. And since then, there have been various other prizes that have been and gone. There was several, including making super efficient vehicles, and also there have been previous prizes to do with the oceans, and this is building on those prizes.
So the newest prize is about the oceans, and what's the problem they want to solve?
Well, so this was announced last month, was a prize all about trying to get scientists to come up with a way of accurately determining the pH of oceans, and also creating detectors which are extremely affordable. So the prize is split into two. One is for the most accurate, one is for the most affordable method. And now, this week, it's been announced that the X Prize wants to launch by 2020 another three ocean-related prizes, X Prizes.
So the pH of an ocean, of course, is because they want to measure the acidity of the oceans, mm-hmm. and oceans are getting more acidic because as there's more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, they absorb into the oceans and you get a sort of very weak form of carbonic acid. Why is that a problem anyway? I mean, what's that doing? It's one of the big issues in climate science as well now, isn't it?
Well, obviously the oceans can only take up so much carbon dioxide, but the problem is that as you make the oceans more acidic, it can affect marine animals, it can affect marine processes, it can affect coral reefs, it can affect a whole host of organisms that are living down there, which are very sensitive to pH changes.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are stories around acidifying oceans essentially dissolving the carbonate shells of animals.
That's the big problem. It's a big problem as well for coral reefs too.
Yeah. So the new prizes, what kinds of problems? I mean, you said that they're ocean-related problems, but what kinds of things are they talking about?
Well, so the new prizes, which seem to be on the agenda, are actually going to be crowdsourced. So they haven't yet revealed what the prizes are going to be, but they want the public to get involved with determining what the biggest issues out there are. So this could be things like trying to clear up plastic waste that's floating in the oceans. It could be due to overfishing. It could be due to pollution. It could be all sorts of different issues that they think need to be tackled, but they want the public to weigh in and scientists to weigh in to help to really focus the efforts and make sure that the prize is addressing the biggest problems.
I mean, the oceans are, most of the Earth is covered by water, and it seems like it's one of those things we say a lot, that the oceans are less explored than a lot of outer space. We know more about stars and galaxies and things, it seems, than what's actually in the at the bottom of the ocean, because it's very difficult to sort of go down there and do all of this. And there doesn't seem to be a huge amount of research funding to allow people just to sort of do all this mapping exercises. We have had very interesting mapping exercises of, you know, fish and other wildlife in the sea over the past decade with the Census of Marine Life, but it's barely scratching the surface. I wonder, though, I mean, are prizes a good idea? I mean, are prizes a good way of doing this? Shouldn't governments all be spending billions of pounds doing this instead?
Well, this wouldn't be the first time that prizes have been used to incentivize research. Back in the early 18th century, the British government offered this prize for the Longitude Prize to help sailors to navigate at sea, and it was very successful. And since then, another amazing prize that has we still see around us all the time is a prize offered by the French military for how to preserve food, which came up with the concept of canning food, which was won by a French confectioner called Nicolas Appert in 1795.
Didn't he come up with cans that contained lead, though?
Wasn't it him? It's all about food and trying to keep your stores there.
That was Napoleon's army, wasn't it? They came up with that, but then it took them a while to come up with a can opener after that.
Yeah, there were problems along the way. There's no doubt there were teething problems, but the point is that this is not a new concept, the idea of offering prizes. And the positives are, you know, it's exciting. It's a challenge. People like challenges. It gets the public interested. The public can get involved. And these are all positive things. It also boosts the profile of both the researchers and the science. But there are downsides.
Yeah, well, I was going to come to that. Just before we go into that, what are the downsides of these prizes? What do you think they do? Do they think they distort things? I mean, I suppose also you've got, you know, just rich people deciding what priorities we should face, right?
Well, yes and no. I mean, obviously, with a more crowdsourcing approach, it isn't just rich people picking their favourite project. It's everybody weighing in and saying, you know, we need to focus on this area, whether it's the acidity of oceans, or, you know, whether it's getting man on the moon or whatever it is. There are downsides. One of them is it's a competition. So this means that the research is likely to be quite closed. People aren't going to be talking about their ideas so much. It's not about sharing of scientific knowledge. It's about, you know, keeping your science very much quiet. That's not necessarily the best way for science to progress, especially these days we're all about sharing scientific information.
Ian, that is a very good point about the fact that this can be closed, but you do get a lot of attention for these things. I mean, how much do we write about the Ansari X Prize and Spaceship One? And look at, I mean, private space flight is now the thing to talk about when it comes to space.
Yeah, and I think Nicholas hit it on the head, actually, that's the most sort of convincing argument against prizes I've heard, that the research tends to be closed, because obviously that's not how science is done or should be done. But I think I haven't really seen a lot of evidence that, you know, these prizes detract from research that would otherwise be done. I mean, I don't know if it's like, you know, we can divide the pie up like that, because, you know, a lot of the government funding and funding from other sources, private industry and so on, will still go to academics and so on. And I don't know whether those funding bodies would like hold back because, oh, well, we're not going to fund work into, you know, things to do with ocean acidification because there's an X Prize for it. I haven't seen that actually happens, and so I'm not sure I sort of buy the sort of, you know, complaints some people have sometimes about, you know, these prizes really sort of detracting from other research. But clearly the work that goes on towards those prizes probably is going to be more closed, as Nicholas says. I think that's an issue.
I think it'd be interesting to see some evidence on this, actually, because the concept that research is going to be closed is definitely there. And for some private companies involved in, say, the X Prize for space travel, of course you're building ships which you funded yourself, and that's going to be closed technology. But if no one else is funding this, then don't the benefits rather outweigh some of those costs?
Well, there are other issues as well. I mean, one of the problems is that this is a prize that you win at the end of the research. So you still have to have the financial capital to invest, first of all, and there's no guarantee you're going to win. And so one of the problems with this is that it essentially shifts all of the risk of the research onto the researcher, and not, you know, it's not like a funding body taking a bit of a gamble on something that could be promising, it may or may not pay off. This is all about awarding the prize once the solution has been found. And so it cannot replace in any way government-funded research. It might boost it.
Ian, another gene for obesity was found last week and published by University of Cambridge scientists. We've been here before, haven't we, with obesity genes?
Well, what was interesting about this one was certainly people have looked at the gene variants that are more common in obese people. So you get a bunch of obese people, look at their genomes and say, okay, what are the genes which may be, you know, at issue here that might be contributing to them being obese. Now, up until now, the gene variants people find are all to do with appetite. So they'll affect how, you know, work through your brain essentially and your act on your desire to eat food and so on. What was interesting about this new gene, which has been around, it's called KSR2. What's nice about it is it's the first time that they've found variants of that or mutations to it that will affect the rate of your metabolism. So this whole idea that, oh, I burn my calories slowly is actually reflected in this gene discovery. It's the first time. It also affects your appetite, but it also shows that your cells, when this gets mutated, your cells oxidize glucose less effectively, and also fatty acids, and also they're obviously the energy sources in your body.
Now, before people jump on this as a potential explanation for lots of obesity, can you explain how many people, or what percentage of the population rather, this gene mutation appears in?
Yeah, so this was the key thing to get into the story. Now, this gene KSR2 is in all of us, and it affects how our cells use glucose and fatty acids in all of us. So it affects metabolism in all of us. But it was found, the mutations were found in a really small and rare group of people who have child obesity, and they make up about 1-2% of the obese population, if you like. So among the general population, these people, you know, make up far less than 1%. Now, what you do is you look for these, you look for the gene variants in these people, and you say, okay, in this particular group of people, the mutations in this gene are causing us a really specific problem, that from childhood, what they're doing is their appetite is increased, but their ability to burn calories is decreased. So they're eating more and they're burning it off less. Now, what does that mean for the general person? Well, you can't, you know, this isn't really, you know, one of those, a genetic reason not to to blame every, you know, obesity on genetics. But what you could hopefully do is, by looking at this pathway, say, well, we all have that at work in us. And so if you look to other obese people, can you actually bring in a drug, say, that would interfere with that pathway, that might improve, you know, the situation for them, that might ensure they put on less weight, even though they aren't in this actually really small portion of society.
There's quite a nice detail in the story about how people with this particular mutation had severe insulin resistance. That's not the nice bit. The nice bit is when they were given diabetes drugs, they lost a considerable amount of weight.
Yeah. So this is a really interesting kind of side aspect to this work, is that when they looked, and it was all of the, they looked at over 2,000 people, and they find that in these people, they have many of them have different kinds of mutations in the particular gene, but all of them had severe insulin resistance. And obviously insulin resistance being a key aspect of diabetes. Now, when they gave metformin, the, you know, classic diabetes drug, which lowers your blood sugar levels, to some of these people, they saw some pretty dramatic weight loss. Now, again, you know, it's really kind of tricky territory. You don't want obese people going around and sort of using diabetes drugs off label for weight loss. But it all points to really interesting scientific territory, that there's clearly a mechanism here which feeds into diabetes and into obesity, that when studied properly and turned into development of drugs, could be more widely applicable.
This is actually fascinating stuff, and it's something I think a lot of people suspected for a while, that there is, you know, genetic links there. I think that there is one danger though, which is that, you know, there will be food companies out there and consumable companies who will see this, or maybe potentially could see this, as a very good thing for them. You know, there's been a lot of press about fructose and how, you know, the EU are going to say if you replace 30% of glucose and sucrose with fructose, you can claim your product's healthier. But we know that there are links between fructose and obesity. This is really important, this genetic link, and it could lead to fantastic medical advances, but we shouldn't take our eye off the ball of the responsibility of food producers as well.
Do you think that food producers are are that cavalier in doing that, though? I mean, like, would they do this? I mean, this is quite basic science, isn't it? And although I think that you're right to sound the warning, I mean, do you see the people doing that sort of thing, or jumping on genetics as the reason for people being fat rather than their high-calorie foods?
I think it's always a complex mix of factors which result in any condition like obesity. It's never going to be down to one thing, and it's important to make sure that all of those things are considered when looking at the problem.
Okay, well, let's move on to our final story for this week, which is, it's all very, well, it's very galactic, really. The most distant galaxy ever found, which brings to mind the old Star Wars adage, really. This is the furthest galaxy we've ever seen. Ian, how far away is it, and where is it? What direction, I should say.
What direction is it?
It's close to the Big Bang somewhere.
That's right. I mean, it's easier if you're in the Northern Hemisphere and you are familiar with the Big Dipper, which is the sort of the saucepan bunch of stars in Ursa Major. Now, if you look at just beyond the tip of the handle and then go about 30 billion light years away from us, then that's where
if you go 30 billion light ways away from us. I mean, it's just, how many whales is that?
How many football pitches? How many Nelson's columns? That's where you'll find this galaxy, which goes by the lovely name of Z8_GND_5296. And this is basically the group of scientists who found this. It had been spotted by Hubble Space Telescope, and they actually looked at 43 really far away galaxies that had been seen by Hubble but never confirmed with spectroscopy. And what they did is used the telescope on Mauna Kea in Hawaii, the Keck telescope, which has a new bit of kit on it called MOSFIRE, which is essentially an infrared spectroscopy instrument. And it looked at light coming from these galaxies. And they only saw, actually, this one galaxy, which of the 43, they only saw this one. And the redshift of it, and we know that, you know, the more something is accelerating away from you, the more redshifted the light is coming from it, because the light's stretched out, the wavelengths are stretched out, and red light has longer wavelengths. The light left about 700 million years after the Big Bang. So this galaxy, the light coming from it that was picked up by the telescope, left 700 million years into the Big Bang, or about 13.1 billion years ago.
The picture of this, which is still worth seeing, is a small red smudge. It's red shifted, which means that it is very, very far away. And it's moving away from us very fast, which is according to Hubble's law, therefore it means it's further away. But what kinds of things, I mean, so there it is, we found it. What was interesting about it that meant that, you know, scientists were interested in studying it?
Well, there's a couple of things to talk through here. I mean, one of the interesting things is that this galaxy is about 40 to 50 times less massive than the Milky Way, and early galaxies tend to be less massive than the more recent ones. But it was producing stars at about 150 times the rate of the Milky Way, which kind of doesn't really figure, because you tend to think that the more massive galaxies will have more intense star creation, because you're turning gas into stars, and you'd imagine the more mass, the easier that's going to be, the more of it's going to go on. Now, what they're saying is, well, maybe this galaxy actually contains more gas than they'd realized, or maybe it's actually drawing in gas from the sort of intergalactic medium at a faster rate and being able to churn out those gases. Now, those stars, now that's kind of, you know, scientifically quite interesting, but why look for these very old and distant galaxies anyway? And these scientists are really on a quest to find the very first galaxies, the first galaxies that came into existence. And these ones are pretty interesting, because they'll tell you something of the evolution of the universe, and they'll tell us something about the evolution of the Milky Way. But in the first galaxies, it was probably in those that you had the first stars that, when they burnt out and when they went supernova, when they exploded, that's where the first elements came from that were heavier than helium. So all of the stuff that we see around us, all of the material that makes up our modern life, was all of the elements there were made originally from exploding stars. And so if you want to go back in time, you can hopefully find the stars that produced the first elements heavier than helium, which make up everything around us.
So this is the oldest observed galaxy. And as you say, we want to find even older ones. What's down coming down the pipe to help us do that? I mean, we've got things like the ALMA Observatory in Chile, which is looking at microwave radiation, and you can use that to actually look through the big clouds of dust that exist in the very early universe, which obscure star formation. And so that's, you can see through that, and that lets you see further back in time. What else have we got coming?
Well, that exact problem is something that the Keck telescope is up against, in that the dust and everything gets in the way of the observations it's trying to make, because it's really trying to just look at one band of light coming through from these galaxies. Now, this one was formed, this galaxy formed around when about 700 million years after the Big Bang. Now, the first galaxies probably formed around 200, 300 million years after the Big Bang. So they're kind of getting towards the period of time when the first galaxies would have been around, but they know they can't go much below where they already are. Now, the best bets really now are on the James Webb Space Telescope, which is due to launch, hopefully, towards the end of the decade. And that's going to be kind of an infrared version of Hubble in a very crude way. But that telescope is due to be sensitive enough and in the right wavelengths to be able to look much further back into the universe to look at some of these super early galaxies.
Nicola, do the heavens move you?
Well, I think what's interesting is how you can, you know, look at the light that's coming from these galaxies and determine what it's made up from, because I believe that they found that there is a huge mix of elements that are being made in this earliest galaxy that we've seen so far, and that's a fascinating area to be able to look back and see exactly what's going on.
This is what spectroscopy is, essentially, isn't it? To look at the light frequencies coming off stars, galaxies, whatever, and each element has its own particular signature. So
it's like a barcode fingerprint, almost.
Yeah, this galaxy has lots of metals or something, I believe. Is that metals in the sense that we think of, or in the way the astronomers think of, which is that astronomers think of anything above helium is a metal to them?
Yeah, essentially.
Excellent. Ian, Nicola, thank you both very much indeed. If you want to read more about any of these stories, you can go to theguardian.com/science. Mary Herbert is a reproductive biologist at Newcastle University. At the recent British Science Festival, she presented the latest scientific insights into how fertility changes in women as they age. It's a subject of growing importance here in the UK and in many developed countries, where women delay having children until later in life. Science Weekly reporter Natalie Starkey caught up with Professor Herbert at the festival to find out more.
So there are two things going on with reproductive aging. In a sense, there are two clocks ticking. One clock is this pool of eggs that you're born with. That becomes depleted throughout life. And the rate at which that becomes depleted depends on how many you got in the first place, and what's the rate of death, because the majority of them do not survive, and then what's the rate of recruitment for growth. Right? So that's one clock, so it's your pool of oocytes. Now the other clock, which seems to tick a bit faster, is the one that's telling your that tells your chromosomes how to divide. So for an egg to be fertilized, before it's fertilized, it's got to halve its chromosome number. And that happens during meiosis. So in all of our cells, we've got 23 pairs of chromosomes, except in our eggs and sperm, where we have 23 chromosomes. So it's got to get rid of a whole chromosome along the way. And for that, cells have evolved this cell division called meiosis. And the effect of aging on that seems to be really marked. So as women get older, say from about mid-35 or so, you get really an increase in chromosome segregation errors during meiosis. So it's the other. That's the other clock, this business of the sort of chromosome aging, if you like. So you've got your depletion of eggs on the one hand, and then as you get to the bottom of that pool, or quite a bit before you get to the end of it, you get the eggs just can't divide properly anymore.
So can we actually measure how many eggs any particular woman has, or is it just all theoretical?
Okay, so there are biochemical measures that are thought to reflect what's called the ovarian reserve. How many do you have left? And that's a hormone, anti-Müllerian hormone, that's most commonly used. And that's produced by growing follicles, right? So you have your resting pool of oocytes, or we call them oocytes when they're immature, but they're immature eggs. And then they are recruited for growth on an ongoing basis. And once they begin to grow, they produce this anti-Müllerian hormone. So you can measure that in the blood, in the systemically. And you can, from there, estimate. It correlates well with how many eggs are there. So that's our current understanding. So that's a biochemical measure of how many eggs we have. But we've got to be a bit careful with that, because it doesn't actually tell us about how healthy those eggs are. So you could have, you know, a woman approaching 40 who has a elevated AMH, everything looks fine in her fertility test, so to speak. But that's not telling us anything about whether her eggs are capable of having the chromosome number properly.
What actually happens to the eggs as they age? Obviously, as we get older, we have fewer of them left. But I mean, what actually happens to the egg itself? Are there actual changes to the egg?
For this, I've got to just give you a little bit of background on how the meiotic division happens. So in order to have our chromosome number, we've got to have the pairs, the homologous pairs, the one we got from our mother and the one that we got from our father, they've got to pair up and form linkages. And they do that by undergoing reciprocal exchange of DNA to form crossovers. So this is what gives us genetic variability in a population. But its most important function is to form those physical linkages between the mom and the dad chromosome so that then they can separate in an orderly way. And the problem then in female meiosis is that that linkage is established during when we're in the uterus, during fetal life. But actually, you know, it's not broken until just before ovulation, some decades later. Mm. And so then we have to ask what is stabilizing those linkages. So it's really important that they're maintained, otherwise these chromosomes can't segregate properly. So it is a protein complex called cohesin acts to clamp chromosomes together. This is for all sorts of mitotic chromosomes and meiotic chromosomes. So once a chromosome is replicated during DNA replication, it needs to stick to it. The two chromatids, as we call them now, need to be bound together. So they're clamped together by this cohesin protein that forms a ring, and they're held there until the cell is ready to divide, and then that ring is opened by an enzyme. So that ring is established, those chromosomes are clamped together during fetal life, and those proteins that hold them together have to be maintained intact until the egg is ovulated. And this is the problem. Work in mice is indicating that this is a major problem, this depletion of these proteins that are clamping the chromosomes together. So they're falling apart and they're not able to segregate in an orderly way. And that seems to, it really is the first molecular correlate between sort of meiotic errors and female aging, because it's something that degrades with age and causes the meiotic errors. So it's taking us obviously we've got to check now that the work is ongoing to see if that is also occurring in human oocytes, but it takes some time to collect enough.
And, you know, is this process reversible at all? Is there research into how we might, if there's something we could take to actually prevent this aging of the eggs itself? I mean, it's the ultimate question, how do we stop our bodies aging? And then we want to focus just on these tiny eggs, but is there any research into that at the moment?
Okay, so from what we know, it's unlikely that you can just inject some of this protein in and have it reloaded to stitch the chromosomes back again. Because we know from studies in Oxford and mouse and Germany as well, that if you make a mouse who, they can genetically engineer mice so that they load a different type of cohesin on the chromosomes during the development of the egg. Now, that doesn't seem to confer cohesion. It might go on the chromosomes, but it doesn't actually have the cohesive properties of the proteins that are loaded on during the DNA replication, if that makes sense.
So it's all about, you know, we have to really make the most of our time when it's there. And I mean, is there any, can we think about our diet and exercise? Do these kind of things prevent aging of these eggs, or is it just a natural process that is just happening regardless of how we treat our bodies?
Okay, so we're not sure yet about what are the mechanisms degrading this cohesin. If it's just an enzyme, a bit of, you know, cutting a cohesin complex or a day or a week or something, it's just something that happens from the beginning, then there's nothing can be done about that. If it's something, if a particular stage of oogenesis, such as when the egg is growing, if that's more susceptible and gets worse as you get older because of reactive oxygen species or whatever, then maybe that's something we can look at intervening in. So we don't know that answer yet, but I should say that in mouse there is some evidence that dietary restriction increases reproductive lifespan. So we don't know if that's the case in humans.
Do you mean calorie restriction or eating certain things?
So it's calorie restriction, and okay. I think it's down to, I forget, it's quite punitive anyway. You know, there's a whole story about dietary restriction and lifespan, general lifespan. Well, the evidence in mouse suggests that increases reproductive lifespan as well.
Wow. So yeah. We just need to eat fewer chocolate bars, maybe. So, I mean, the other thing is, obviously, IVF has really boomed in recent years. Mm. And And maybe is this just the solution, you know, for women who have their careers on the go and are too busy to stop and have children, which, you know, ultimately takes a lot of time out of a woman's career. Can they just hope that IVF is the answer? If, you know, they're going to be using their own eggs, you're saying the eggs are aging. But is it better just, can we just wait for IVF, or is this a dangerous game that we're playing?
Yes, I think that's a dangerous game. I mean, sadly, there's reproductive technologies as we use them now can't do very much to buy time. For women, because if we're getting the eggs at the stage where they're already in trouble, there's nothing you can do to reverse that. So current technologies would be offering donor eggs, which means that a woman doesn't have a child who's genetically hers. And then the other possibility is to freeze eggs. So we can now vitrify eggs. That technology is developing all the time. But it's really important for women to understand if they're thinking about that they need to do that early.
What do you mean by early?
Well, you know, ideally start thinking in your 20s about doing that.
But that's a procedure that is expensive, I'm guessing, and it's not on the NHS, I'm guessing, at the moment.
I'm guessing it's not on the NHS, no. And I wouldn't think for some time, if ever. It's not something every 20-year-old is going to be thinking about, for sure. If a woman is thinking, you know, maybe this is something I do need to think about, it better to do it sooner rather than later, because there's no point banking the eggs once they're already having problems.
So what, you know, really, what's your advice to women? It sounds to me like you're saying, you know, basically get on with it a bit earlier if you want to have children. But I mean, the problem is a lot of women don't know if they want children young, and they're busy, you know, at university maybe, or starting out on their career. But you're kind of saying that you can't really leave it. You're saying kind of 35, as we always hear, is the cutoff. Is that kind of still the case?
Well, you know, it's difficult to be definite about what age, because women's ovaries will age at different rates and so on. But, you know, by the time, you know, to start thinking about it when you're 35, right, it's going to be fine for plenty of women, but there are those for which, you know, that will get into trouble. And certainly by the time you get sort of towards 40, it's really getting rather, you know, you're really fighting against the clock by then. So I suppose the advice, I mean, it's very, very difficult, because there are complex things. I'm sure the decision-making processes are very complex, and how we deal with risk, because I'm sure on some level every woman knows that there is a risk, but you're blindsiding it. You're saying, I don't know what way we deal with risk on a personal level. You say, okay, I won't be affected. Something will be developed by the time I get to that stage. It's unlikely something will be developed really by the time, you know, in the next few generations, I would think. So the advice would be, I don't know, you know, in an ideal world, people would have their children early, and you know, stopping off to build your career first it would be great if women could have children easily while they're building their careers. Because, you know, you get to, you're successful in your career, it becomes more difficult to take the time then. I think we need to raise awareness about the problem as a public health issue, and something where women need information, because they're going all the time to the GPs for their birth control, where the emphasis is on preventing pregnancy. And they end up going from there then to a fertility clinic. And by the time they get to a fertility clinic, it's a bit late. So it's just falling between this sort of family planning service that's focused on preventing pregnancy to an infertility clinic that's, you know, where there's not much can be done for older women.
So as a researcher who's investigating these kind of topics, how do you think we might, you know, bring up this subject in the wider media and the public? It obviously needs discussion, and it's not happening at the moment, and maybe at the level that it should be. Can you make any recommendations of how we might increase the knowledge about this area?
I think, I mean, the instruments for these things, I don't know, are there focus groups, policy groups that have a look and see, well, what are the factors influencing people's decisions here? What is the impact of it? I mean, because it has an impact beyond the tragedy of involuntary childlessness. It's got a lot of healthcare costs associated with it, you know, in terms of all the testing, terminations, then if people decide to have a baby who has Down syndrome or whatever, then, you know, these are very difficult decisions for people, but they also have knock-on implications on the cost of providing healthcare. So I think it just needs a bit of interrogation, I think, at a sort of policy level. You know, there are countries you could look at, such as Sweden, where there's free childcare. Does that make a difference to them? You know, where they tax and pay for childcare out of that, and to understand what is the impact of the childcare thing. I think they're very complex decisions. the way people play with risk and the kind of am I ready decision is very difficult. As a simple researcher, I can't answer that question. I'm sorry.
Well, thank you very much for speaking to us today. It's been really interesting.
Thank you.
Professor Mary Herbert there of Newcastle University speaking with our reporter, Natalie Starkey. That's all we have for you this week. Remember to top up your science knowledge day or night. Go to theguardian.com/science. But from me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, thanks for listening.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.